Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, AWM Program Director Allison Sansoni chats with renowned poet and leader of the Black Arts Movement, Dr. Haki Madhubuti, about his recent collection, Taught by Women, Poems as Resistance Language. This program took place May 20th, 2021, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
My name is Allison Sansoni, and I'm the program director here at the Writers Museum. We're grateful to all of you for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. We're here tonight to talk about the poetry of struggle and resistance with one of its foremost practitioners, a legend of American writing whose belief in the idea of words of authority is one of the reasons the American Writers Museum exists today. Dr. Haki Madhubuti's newest collection, Taught by Women, honors the female scholars, poets, comrades, and colleagues who educated and inspired him. Dr. Madhubuti is an award-winning poet, one of the architects of the Black Arts Movement, an essayist, educator, founder, and publisher emeritus of Third World Press and Third World Press Foundation. He is the author and or editor of over 36 books of poetry and nonfiction. A longtime community activist and institution builder, he's co-founder of the Institute of Positive Education and its three schools in Chicago. He retired in 2011 after a 42-year distinguished teaching career that included Cornell University, Howard University, Chicago State University, where he was appointed its first university distinguished professor, and was the founding director of its MFA program in creative writing, and DePaul University, where he served as the last Ida B. Wells Barnett University professor. In addition to Taught by Women, Madhubuti's most recent books are Taking Bullets, Terrorism and Black Life in 21st Century America, and Not Our President, New Directions from the Pushed Out, the Others, and the Clear Majority in Trump's Stolen America. I'd like to welcome him here with us tonight.
How you doing?
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation. I'm really happy to be here, especially since I was at the founding of the American Writers Museum. And very happy that y'all are doing so well.
Thank you. Thank you. I understand you wanted to start by with a reading for us tonight.
Yes, I would. And thank you for the introduction. It was very accurate. And Taught by Women is a book that I've been working on for the last 3 years. So I'm going to read a few poems and in between just say a few words for about 20 minutes or so. Taught by Women is my acknowledgement and thank you to over half of the world's population who remain too often property, raped, honored, killed, diminished, enslaved, lynched, dismissed, excluded, lied to, abused, sexualized, sex trafficked, devalued, demeaned, executed, imprisoned, forgotten, forced into unwanted marriages, miseducated, undereducated, beheaded, and bodily disfigured, all motivating me to be pro-girl and woman, which requires serious listening, specialized learning, advanced thought, care, action, and language that highlights Black music, poetry, and visual art, which I received from my mother, a woman who worked and died in the sex trade of the 1950s, just as capitalism, white supremacy, Black ignorance, enslavement, and anti-religious thought killed her, I, her only son, am able today and tomorrow to act and state with finality, stop. And again, thank you to Black women and the world of women for saving my life. And my mother, who was not a formally educated woman, she did not even finish high school, but she was a woman that was too pretty. And we moved, as John Oliver Kittlesman said, from Little Rock, Arkansas, up south to Chicago and Detroit, Michigan. And she found herself, because of her beauty, in the sex trade. And that sex trade, for the most part, ended up killing her. But in killing her, made me. And I'll explain that as I go on in terms of the book. But the book itself is my thank you to literally a couple hundred women, because the front cover, back cover, inside front cover, and back cover are the names of the women to whom I'm giving thanks to. So I'm a poet. And what we have built in Chicago, most certainly Third World Press and Third World Press Foundation, in our schools, Institute of Public Education, Betty Shabazz School, the Barbara Ann Sizemore Academy, came about as a result of I and other people I've been working with in struggle for many, many years. So I, as a poet, for the consideration of poets, where is the poetry of resistance? The poetry of honorable defiance, unafraid of the lies from career politicians and businessmen, not respectful of journalists who write, official speak, void of educated thought, without double search or subsurface questions that war talk demands. Where is the poetry of doubt and suspicion? Not in the service of the state, bishop, and priests, not in the service of beautiful people and late night promises, not in the service of influence, incompetence, and academic clown talk. Coming up in America has not been easy for me or for most Black people, brown people, Asian American, people who are not white. And if you're poor white, you probably had it pretty difficult also. And what I've tried to do in Taught by Women, I write about myself in a piece called Art 2, Reviewing a Life, a Calling. And I'm just going to read one section of that. Among these senior words, this questioning and quieting narrative, art, and all this imperfection contributed wonderfully to the defining history of my life. Like, why am I accused of being too Black, 60s Black, but never too white? As a doer in this world, as a committed poet, politician, political and cultural activist, educator, publisher, questioner, questioning intellectual, business trier, husband, father, cultural father, word organizer, editor, institution builder, protector of children, and pro street fighter, I have swum in an ocean not of my making. After over 78 years of an imperfect backstroke, I realize the many countless times I've been close to drowning, only to reemerge stronger, in part due to the thousands of special and not so special people, children, young voices, and the children of children, and the women who birthed them, who I've encountered in this life, in this struggle, on many continents. I'm here because of poetry, Black poetry, and poetry of all cultures, in its multitudes of forms, laced with an abundance of content, critical meaning, and local selves. And so for me, writing a poetry gave me the introduction to not only the poetry of many cultures, but the poetry of my own people. And most certainly for me, the poet who stood out the most and helped me the greatest was Gwendolyn Brooks. Gwendolyn Brooks and I became family back in 1967. And for over 33 years, we've been able to interact, and she guided me. And I tried to serve her in those 33 years. This poem, Liberation Narratives, speaks to why we as a people, or any people who are in control of their own cultural imperatives, about developing a liberation narrative. One, it may be a man's world, yet it's women who write music that navigate the harmony that grows children, drives learning, preparing knives for the cutting of green beans and lies, while dodging genocide and rape, as men who run the world, bathe in the power of extreme illusion, overuse collateral damage and deficit language to justify it's a man's world. Best advice to men, marry women smarter than you, and occasionally let them know it. Three, My mother was prettier than imagination, soaked in honey flavored with hot water and lemon. Her heart was there too. She was a short poem, dead at 34, buried without flowers, notation or truthful stories. She challenged men walking on her life like she was a used thread mill years before they were invented. I have her eyes. I see damage everywhere. I have become a stop sign. 4. Janet liked girls and told them so. Robert liked boys and kept it a secret. Both grew into teenagers, still liking girls and still liking boys. Each kept their desires to themselves. In the 21st century, parts of the world began to mature and finally understood why Janet loved women and Robert loved men. They were born that way. Enough said. 5. If poetry is to have meaning, it must mean something. More than metaphor and simile, more than tree talk and looking for gigs, more than competition and unrhymed free verse, serious to the bone of incomprehension, surely to land the poet a Guggenheim or MacArthur genius grant. Artists should not expect from readers, listeners, and observers fairness, objectivity, or deep knowledge or wordplay, or interpreted ideas of paint or jumping notes. Often a smile will do. And yes, to buy and share books, visuals, and music will help. Saying yes to children may get you into heaven. Saying no to war bills, character, and conscience. Giving 10% of what you own to the homeless will aid in your sleeping a full night, hopefully to awaken creating healthier poems, prose, pictures, and critical perceptions of the letter P, beyond politics, potholes, profiteers, poverty, pimp juice, patriots, partisans, and playboys of the Western world. 6, if you don't know who you are, anybody can name you. And 7, if the world loses elephants, dolphins, polar bears, frogs, trees, the ability of the majority to do good, clean water, prayer, and meditation in all languages, love across borders, honest vegans and vegetarians, a mother's love, a father's caring, children dancing to knowledge and colors, artists not lying for money, privilege, or fame. If the world loses books, newspapers, clear thinkers, practical doers, poets, promising futures for the great majority, rainforest, a world vocabulary that accents yes and possibilities rather than no, and you can't do that. If the world loses the great apes, schools, giraffes, salmon, the coral reef, insects, worms, organic farmers, compost, green tea, workers who use their hands to build and repair stuff, North and South Poles, teachers, people of faith, engineers, wheatgrass, carrot juice, oatmeal, and 7-grain bread. If the world loses you and water, yes, precious you in the daily taste of life, it finally means that we lost butterflies yesterday and failed our children. You know, all too often, we really do not know what poetry is, and we have these ideas that poetry just rhyme and anybody could do it. And that may be correct, that most people can indeed write poetry, but we all need inspiration, we need instruction, we need to read poetry to actually understand what poetry actually is. So a few years ago, maybe a decade or so, maybe longer than that, I wrote this poem titled Poetry to try to give some direction. Poetry would not stop or delay wars, would not erase rape from the landscape, would not cease murder or eliminate poverty, hunger, or excruciating fear. Poems do not command armies, run school systems, or manage money. Poetry is not intimately involved in the education of psychologists, physicians, or smiling politicians. In this universe, the magic, the beauty, the willful art of explaining the world and you. The timeless, the unread, the unstoppable fixation with language and ideas. The visionary, the satisfiable equalizer, screaming for the vitality of dreams, interrupting false calm, demanding fairness and a new world are the poets and their poems. Poetry is the wellspring of traditions. The Bleeding Connector Yesterdays and the Free Passport to Futures. Poems bind people to language, link generations to each other, and introduce cultures to cultures. Poetry, if given the eye and ear, can bring memories, issue in laughter, rein in beauty, and cure ignorance. Language in the context of the working poem can raise the minds of entire civilizations, speak to two-year-olds, and render some of us wise. To be touched by living poetry can only make us better people. The determined force of any age is the poem, and old as ideas and life-giving as active lovers. A part of any answer is in the rhythm of the people. Their heartbeat comes urgently in two universal forms, music and poetry. For the reader, for the quiet seeker, for the many willing to sacrifice one syllable mumblings and easy conclusions, poetry can be that gigantic river that allows one to recognize in the circle of fire, the center of life. And so in writing about poetry and poets, on the cover of Taught by Women, that first name up here is Gwendolyn Brooks, and then Margaret Burroughs, Barbara Ann Sizemore, and then Carol D. Lee, my wife. And these are the four women that start off in terms of having aided me a great deal. And here's an early picture of Gwendolyn Brooks and myself, okay, it's in the book. And Gwendolyn Brooks, more than any other writer, poet, was a woman who essentially told me quite early, except 25 years old, 24, 25 years old, when I first met her on the South Side of Chicago, teaching the Blackstone Rangers poetry writing, working with Oscar Brown Jr., the great poet, writer, entertainer himself, that I had promised. I walked in that morning with other writers from OBASI, Organization of Black American Culture. And after she finished teaching these young people, she walked over to greet us. And I gave her a copy of my first book, which was Think Black, which had been published in 1966, 66, 67. And Think Black was a white cover with the continent of Africa on the front, my name. And she looked at it for about 5 or 10 seconds and then took the book and put it to her heart. And she said, young man, I'm going to read this tonight. And that started a 33-year familyhood. And this is the last poem I wrote for Gwendolyn Brooks, which was on the centennial. The title of the poem is Gwendolyn Brooks, America in the Wintertime. In this moment of orangutans, wolves, and scavengers, of high heat, redesigning the North and South Poles, and the wanderings of new tribes and limousines, with the confirmations of liars, thieves, and get-over artists, in the wilderness of Pennsylvania Avenue, Standing Rock, misspelled executive orders on yellow paper with crooked signatures. Where are the kind language makers among us? At a time of extreme climate damage, deciphering fake news, alternative truths, and me-ism, you saw the 21st century and left us. Not on your own accord or permission. You have fought and fought most of the 20th century, creating an army of poets and learned and loved language and stories. Poets who are complicated with rivers, seas, and oceans. Where is the kind green nourishment of kale and wheatgrass? You thought, wrote, and lived poetry. Knew that terror is also language-based on denial, firstism, and rich cowards. You were honey and yes to us. Never ran from Black, as in bones, Africa, blood, and questioning yesterdays and tomorrows. We never saw you dance, but you had rhythm. You were a warrior before the war, creating earth language, uncommon signs and melodies, and did not sing the songs of career slaves. Keenly aware of Tubman, Douglas, Wells Barnett, Du Bois, the oversized consciousness and commitment of never quit people, religiously taking notes of the bloodlust enemies of kindness. We heard your last words. America, if you see me as your enemy, you have no friends. And so for over 33 years, Gwendolyn Brooks, the first Black to win the Pulitzer Prize, was our keen direction giver. And we miss her dearly. There was another writer who came a generation after Gwendolyn Brooks, and more of my peer, even though she's my teacher also, and that's Sonia Sanchez. You know, Sonia Sanchez and I met back in 1968. And for all these years, we've been truly brother and sister. And she's been one of, as Gwendolyn Brooks, one of the major persons, along with Amiri Baraka, Kalama Yassalam, Jane Cortez, and going and on, who helped build Third World Press. You've seen me, Eugene Perkins here in Chicago too. But Sonia Sanchez has been a dear sister. And I'm just going to read, I wrote a long poem about Sonia Sanchez in the book, but I'm just going to read one stanza for Sonia Sanchez. Poet, how are you going to make a living? By joining the word creators, the smile makers, the happy hands, feet movers, doubt catchers, subsurface explorers, idea incubators. The look you in the eye, say yes, people. Where are today's impossible task takers? The 24/7 bush women, men and young people living on promises, coffee, the breath of lies, bad food, tea, each other, and the wonderment of discovery from the Black Arts Movement of fire to the hip hop movement of rain without sunshine, moon, or the underside of heat and mud. You recognized and called the young to conference to listen as they rap the underside of ugly, teaching them to never forget mamas, sisters, grandmamas. Reveal that stopping the women stops the future. Ha ha. Stop the women stops the future. Ha ha ha. We stood on the shoulders of Houston, Wright, McKay, Tuma, Tolson, Danner, Fanon, Hayden, Du Bois, Robeson, Locke, Brown, Cullen, Garvey, Washington, Douglas, Wheatley, Dunbar, Woodson, Wells Barnett, and the drowned voices of a people becoming whole. And we are whole because of Sonia Sanchez and other writers of our generation. And so as I move toward ending this reading, I have to talk about my wife, Dr. Carol D. Lee. As we know her from our schools, Mama Safisha. But my wife is brilliant, and she is why we have built these institutions that we have here in Chicago. You all may know my wife as Dr. Carol D. Lee. She's a former president of AERA, American Education Research Association. She has been inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, inducted into the American, to the Academy of Education, National Academy of Education. In fact, she's the president-elect of the National Academy of Education. And of course, she's the co-founder of our three schools here and helped develop Third World Press, Third World Press Foundation. But my mother, Helen Maxine Graves Lee, was a woman that was too pretty. And I'll end this reading with this poem about my mother. She was dead at 34. And so that means I've been on my own since I was 16 years old and ended up in the military at 18, 3 years there. And then of course, after I came out of the military, ended up in Black struggle. But used those 3 years to re-educate myself in terms of Black writing, Black struggle, international African struggle and so forth. But Helen Maxine, my mother started me on this journey when she asked me to go to the Detroit Public Library at 14 years old to check out a book by Richard Wright. And I refused to go because I hated myself. I hated my color. I hated our economic circumstances. We were extremely poor. I hated everything about our lives. But she insisted, because even though she had not, was not a well-educated woman, she was a self-educated woman. And Richard Wright was on her reading list. And so I went to the Troy Public Library, and I did not want to ask the white librarian, because this is back in the 50s. I want to ask the white librarian for a book with Black in the title that was authored by a Black writer who I was told was critical of white America. Why? Because I hated myself. I found the book on the shelf. I put it to my chest. I walked to an unpeopled section of the library and sat down and began to read. I read over, the book brought me into the content rather quickly, because he was the first Black writer I've read, number one, and he was not an embarrassment to read. And each word, each sentence, each paragraph, each chapter brought me into the book. I read half the book that day in the library all day, took it home, finished it overnight. And by the next day, I had become, most certainly, if not a changed person, I had become a young teenager who began to ask questions about who we are, why we're here, why we're so poor. You know you're poor if you're wearing used underwear. That's how poor we were. I was, anyway. And gave it to my mother. And the next day, I went and got out, checked out everything Richard Wright had published. And the one book that helped me the most become a writer, become a poet, was his book of essays, White Man Listen, which one of the major essays was on Negro literature. So my mother, who was actually murdered, she had gone on a job for a weekend, actually overnight anyway, and she didn't return. And so I found her that Sunday afternoon, beaten to death. And she had been beaten so badly that we did not open the casket at her funeral. Helen Maxine. My mother was so beautiful that she not only stopped cars, she stopped buses. Her beauty, if just for a moment, made most men's eyes roam and forget other women. She was music unemployed. She wrapped her body in clothes that refused to hide the nature of her desires. She wanted to be a dancer. She wanted to be warm weather year round. She wanted to know the origins of walnuts and wealth. She wanted to play the harmonica and sing like Billie Holiday. She believed in God, kind Negroes, reciprocity, and Southern food. Her clothes got in the way of men taking them off. And so this is just a sample of taught by women. And if you just go with the cover of the book, the women, other than those I mentioned earlier, you got Shirley Graham Du Bois, Ida B. Wells, Mary McLeod Bethune, Rosa Parks, Katherine Dunham, and so forth, taught by women.
Thank you for those incredible words.
Thank you.
Dr. Madhubuti, this book is expansive. It spans so much of your career. How did you choose the subjects that you decided to address?
Well, the women other than my mother who mentored me they're all deceased now, was Margaret Burroughs, who founded, along with others, the DuSable Museum of African-American History. Barbara Ann Sizemore, one of the premier world-class educators. In fact, she was the first Black superintendent of the Washington, D.C. school system. And while she was superintendent there, I was teaching at Howard University. And we got to be very close. And then, of course, Gwendolyn Brooks, who ended up becoming my cultural mother over 33 years. So the book in part, and of course my wife, whom I talked about a little bit earlier, but the book in part is a thank you to them And of course, I mentioned, you know, I mentioned Sonia Sanchez and other writers that are in the book too. And so I came along at a time when the approach toward women was very sexist. I mean, extremely. I mean, it was like normal to be sexist, okay? And so I think that with my mother and seeing what she had to go through, that it had shaped me a little bit differently than other men. And then 3 years in the military, I really began to see that I did not want to be like this, because basically in the military, they teach you to kill, number one. And number two, in the United States Army, that was the organization of men that went to take other people's worlds, which I did not want to be a part of. And so as I read and studied, I read close to a book a day while I was in the military, because I stayed in trouble, because at that time, this was between 1960 and 63, whatever company I was in, I was the only Black man. And it was always a battle, always a battle. And so as I read, as I studied, and as these women took me under their large arms and taught me, and that's where this book comes from. It comes from the interaction with these women. And wherever I taught, the women were very kind to me, okay? And most certainly at my last post, well, last two posts, but let's say you talk about Chicago State, where I stayed there for 26 years, you got Kelly Norman Ellis, a serious poet. You got Brenda Gawa. I mean, they are still there. And of course, our current poet laureate, you know, in this state, has been Angela Jackson. Has been, I mean, she's younger than I, but she's been a teacher in many cases. And so that's where this book come from. And all I can say, Allison, is that without these women, I wouldn't be here. I mean, even look at my own daughters. You know, I just, all of them has basically saw that there was some promise in me. And help me out. And of course, Gwendolyn Brooks' daughter, Nora Brooks Blakely, who is carrying on the legacy of her mother by maintaining her mother's name, and we placed her papers down at the University of Illinois. And of course, in Chicago State, we have now the library at Chicago State named after Gwendolyn Brooks. And we are building a kind of a Gwendolyn Brooks room out there at Chicago State. And so but all along the way, once you begin to listen to women and really begin to understand how, and that's why I wrote the first piece in the book, how women have basically been taken advantage of by men, by ignorant-ass men. And if you got any sensitivity and any understanding of how the world should work, then you're going to listen to these women.
How has the writing process changed for you over the course of your career? How did you write in the beginning, and how is it different now?
The only difference now, Allison, is I have a little bit more time. You know, we founded the Third World Press in 67, and from that point all the way up until teaching at all these different universities and trying to make a living and trying to. You see, when you're building institutional structures like Third World Press in our schools, you can't pay people with a poem. You got to earn money, okay? And much of the money in the early days came from my speaking around the country and around the world. I'm probably one of the few poets of any culture. I've spoken and given workshops in every state in the union, except South Dakota, North Dakota, Utah, Alaska, and on four continents. You know, I had a chance to meet four presidents, African presidents. So everything I've earned, at least one third of it, if not one half of it, has gone back to building these institutional structures. So you're always running, always running, always running. And so I've always written on a paper, generally a legal pad, and I write with a pen. And even though I'm talking with you now through my iPad, I don't write on an iPad. I just use it for whatever, like this stuff here, but I still write longhand. Okay. Then I have a very, very able and very serious assistant associate for over 20 some odd years, Rose Perkins at Third World Press. She has basically been a person who has helped translate some of this bad writing. But let me just say this, that I've been able to give this time now, especially over the last year or so, to actually writing more because we've changed the leadership at Third World Press, Third World Press Foundation. The new president is Dr. Romy Crawford. That's R-O-M-I, Romy Crawford. She's on the faculty at our institute. The new executive director is Dr. Lasana Kazembe at IUPUI up in Indiana. And then, of course, the new publisher is Dr. Michael Samanka. He's at Morehouse down in Atlanta. And so with these three persons, plus Rose and Antoine and others who work with, and Willard and Fox and others, we've been able to get some time to write. Okay. And so I'm still writing longhand, and I'm working on I'm working on two books, actually. One, the second part of my memoir. The first one was Yellow Black. The second part is New Music Screaming in the Sun. And I'm working on a book. I'm a vegan. I've been a vegan for about 40 years. And I'm writing a book titled The Autobiography of a Black Vegan.
You touched on this a little bit during your reading, but and your thoughts. But, you know, you talked in the book about you were finding refuge in Black literature. And other than, you know, you mentioned Richard Wright. Were there others that you read that you connected with that had that same impact on you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, other than Richard Wright, obviously Gwendolyn Brooks, Margaret Walker Alexander, well, everybody, Toni Morrison, Claude McKay, W.B. Du Bois. And Du Bois was really a major influence because W.B. Du Bois, who's a major scholar, but very few people realize that he was also a poet, okay? And of course, very activist and sociologist and political scientist. And Du Bois and I were born on the same day, but, you know, obviously 60, 70 years apart. But Du Bois, Carter G. Woodson, my wife and I, we have a massive library. And as coming up as a young man, my second home was used bookstores. Okay. And basically, I would find first editions of really serious Black literature for 25 cents, 30 cents. I mean, you can't find it today, but in the early days. So I would read, especially the novelist, Chester Himes, okay? And of course, when I was able to meet and interact with James Baldwin, Jimmy Baldwin, when he came on the scene, he was very influential in terms of early essays, writing essays, and even his fiction. But for the most part, it's always been the poets, okay, that basically taken me into different directions. You know, Jane Cortez, she was one of the major poets to come out of the Black Arts Movement. And as a result of not only reading these poets and studying these poets, becoming friends with them, you know, so that helped a great deal. And for 8 years, Allison, I taught at Howard University, but I was one of the few professors, Black or any culture, to commute between Chicago and DC every week. And the university, they paid for it, because they knew I was trying to work with other people back in Chicago to create these institutional structures. And so I had a chance to build these writers' conferences at Howard University with great writers like John Oliver Killens, the fiction writer, and the great cultural scientist, Stephen E. Henderson. And then, of course, when we came to Chicago State, we started these writers' conferences, and we did about 20 of them, Gwendolyn Brooks writers' conferences, as well as we built the Gwendolyn Brooks Center for Creative Writing and Black Literature. And with Kelly Norman Ellis, we built the first MFA in creative writing at predominantly Black University. So this literature, this is one reason I was, when they call, you call, call for the American Writers Museum. I came, you know, to help. And because this is in my blood, writing is in my blood, but literature is in my blood. And the importance of, see what I'm saying? The best way to defeat ignorance, read books. That's it. Libraries are anti-ignorance. Okay. And so if you, again, I get back to what I say this all the time. If you don't know who you are, anybody can name you. And that the best way to find out who you are is to study. And to study, well, certainly if you're a person of African ancestry, study Black literature. Read the fiction, read the literary nonfiction, read the politics and so forth. And so all my life, that's what I've been surrounded with. And it has helped a great deal.
Several of the poems in the book mention the importance of listening to young people, especially in social justice movements. And I wondered, who are the young writers and the young activists and artists that you that interest you, that excite you, who are working today?
Well, it's obviously Ta-Nehisi Coates. Okay, he's getting a lot of play now. And when we turned 50, we had a 50-year celebration. He came to help me. You know, locally, you got Ewing, Elva Ewing, E-V-E-L, Ewing. She's a poet, and her mother was very active at the same, but she's a poet, went on and got a PhD. So I think she's very influential. Tara Bates.
Oh, Eve Ewing. I think that's how you
read it. Eve Ewing. And but I'm not as up on the young writers as I should be, right? Primarily because I'm old. All right. I mean, I'll listen to almost anybody, but for the most part, I'm not where I should be in terms of reading all of them. Yeah, Eve Ewing, that's it. Right. I read one book of poetry by her. You know. But we have in this city, Chicago, a grand legacy. And just like the American Writers Museum, we have also the, Gill Complex, which is a nurturer of young writers. And of course, people working there, most certainly some of the early people to support the Gill Complex, Reginald Gibbings and Mike Pollan. Then you got the, Chicago Literary Hall of Fame. The Chicago Literary Hall of Fame, that's with Donald Evans. And the other, well, you got, New Lit, New City Lit, the journal that publishes, and you got, of course, these, as well as the national stuff. But I always focus on what's local.
Well, thank you so much for being here with us tonight and for sharing those poems and so much of your thoughts with us. And I wanted to ask just before we conclude tonight, if you had any final thoughts that you wanted to share.
Well, I would hope that people buy Taught by Women and share it with brothers and sisters. All of my books that have sold well have been taught, and I'm one of the few poets who have national and somewhat international influence, whose all my books have been published by Black publishers. Okay, whether it's Broadside Press, Lotus Press, or Third World Press. And so I'll just, kind of end by just stating that it is much easier to believe than to think. Okay. And that people who think are readers. And so if we're going to be decision makers in our lives, we've got to be readers. And there's an important difference between a decision maker and a person who makes choices about one's life. The thinker, the decision maker, it makes the decisions and provide the parameter that other people make choices in. So I tell young people all the time, go to school, get multiple degrees, but understand that if you're going to speak for yourself and your tomorrow, and it's your tomorrow, young people, it's your tomorrow, that you have got to understand that stopping the women stops the future. We got to support women.
Thank you very much for that. And thank you everyone for being here with us tonight.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. We'll return with new episodes in August. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.